darkness was interspersed with panels of light positioned at regular intervals. They extended on as far as he could see. Ethan turned over onto his hands and knees and crawled across the metal for 20 feet until he reached the first one. Stopped at the edge, a jolt of fear-tinged excitement coursing through him. It wasn't a panel of light. It was a vent. He stared through it, down onto a flooring of checkered tile. The air blowing through the duct had taken on a lovely warmth, like an ocean breeze in the dead of July. For a long time, he waited, watching. Nothing happened. There was the sound of moving air and his respirations, of the metal expanding and contracting, and nothing else. Ethan took hold of the vent by its grating. It lifted easily away, no screws, no nails, no welding holding it in place. Setting the grate aside, he grabbed hold of the edge and tried to build the nerve to climb down. Chapter 16. Ethan lowered himself out of the duct until his bare feet touched the black and white checkered tile. He stood in the middle of a long, empty corridor. There was the hum of the fluorescent lights and the soft whoosh of air moving through the ductwork above him, but no other sound. His feet made a quiet slap against the tile as he began to walk. There were doors spaced out every 20 feet with numbers on them, and the one up ahead on his right was barely cracked and spilling a bit of light out onto the floor. He reached it, number 37, and put his hand on the doorknob. Listened. No voices, no movement, nothing to turn him away. He pushed the door open another inch and looked inside. There was a single bed on a metal frame against the far wall, perfectly made. A desk decorated with framed photographs and some tulips in a vase. His eyes passed over a floor-to-ceiling bookshelf, a Matisse print, an easel. Beside the door, a terry cloth robe hung from a hook in the wall, a pair of pink bunny slippers beneath it. He went on down the silent corridor. None of the doors was locked, and each one he took the risk of opening revealed a similar minimalist living space, brightened with a few flourishing touches of individuality. After an impressive distance, the corridor terminated in a stairwell, Ethan standing at the top and staring down, counting 4 flights to the bottom. A placard on the wall read, Level 4. He crept down to the next landing, which delivered him onto another corridor that looked identical to the one above. Hard, sudden laughter resonated through the hall. It drove Ethan back into the stairwell and primed him to flee. He was already figuring he could return to Level 4, use a chair from one of those apartments to climb back up into the air shaft. But the laughter died down, and after he'd waited a full minute, the corridor remained empty. He padded 30 feet in, finally stopping in front of a pair of swinging doors, each inset with a small window. A group of 3 men and 2 women occupied 1 of a dozen tables in a modest cafeteria, the smell of hot food making Ethan's stomach rumble. One of the women said, "You know that's not true, Clay," pointing a fork at him that had speared a glob of what looked like mashed potatoes. Ethan moved on down the corridor. He passed a laundry, a rec room, a library, an empty gymnasium, men's and women's locker rooms, an exercise room where 2 women jogged side by side on treadmills, and a man lifted free weights. Ethan came to the stairwell at the far end and descended a flight of stairs that led out into the Level 2 corridor. At the first door he came to, he stopped and peered inside through its circular window. There was a gurney in the center, surrounded by lights, carts loaded with surgical instruments, heart monitors, IV stands, cautery and suction units, a fluoroscopy table, all immaculately clean and glimmering under the low light. The next 3 doors were windowless and identified only by nameplates, Lab A, Lab B, Lab C. Down toward the end of the corridor, 1 window glowed and Ethan sidled up beside it. On the other side of the glass, tapping and the murmur of soft, low voices, he peered through the window. The room was mostly dark, its glow coming from numerous monitors, 25 of them in 5 stacks of 5 mounted to the wall and perched above a large console that looked serious enough to launch a rocket. 10 feet from where Ethan stood, a man sat staring up at them, his fingers moving at light speed across a keyboard as the images on the screens constantly changed. He wore a headset, and Ethan could just hear his voice coming through, though the words were lost. On one of the screens, Ethan studied the slideshow of images. The facade of a Victorian house, the porch of a different house, an alleyway, a bedroom, an empty bathtub, a bathroom with a woman standing in front of a mirror, brushing her hair, a man seated at a kitchen table eating a bowl of cereal, a child sitting on a toilet reading a book, a view of Main Street in Wayward Pines, the playground at the park, the cemetery, the river, the interior of the coffee shop, the hospital lobby, Sheriff Pope sitting behind his desk with his feet kicked up, talking on the telephone. Ethan's line of sight was limited through the window, but he could just make out the left edge of another block of monitors and the sound of other people typing. A pool of hot rage went supernova somewhere deep inside him. He put his hand on the doorknob, started to turn it. He would have loved nothing more than to creep up behind the man as he watched people going about their private lives and snap his neck. But he stopped himself. Not yet. Ethan backed away from the surveillance center and headed down the stairwell, emerging into the bottom corridor, level 1. Though difficult to tell from this distance, at the far end it appeared to extend beyond the stairwell into another section of the complex. Ethan picked up his pace. Every 10 feet he moved past a door with no handle, no apparent method of entry beyond a keycard slot. Third one down on his left, he stopped, glanced through the small window into darkness, just an empty room. He did the same at the 10th door down, stopping and cupping his hand over his eyes so he could draw more detail out of the shadows. The face of one of those creatures from the canyon crashed into the glass on the other side, its teeth bared and hissing. Ethan stumbled back into the opposite wall, his system buzzing from the scare as the thing screeched behind the glass, thick enough to dampen most of the sound. Footfalls echoed in the stairwell he'd just been on. Ethan hurried down the corridor, moving as fast as he could, the fluorescent fixtures scrolling past in a stream of artificial light. He glanced over his shoulder as he reached the stairwell, saw 2 figures in black moving into the far end of the corridor 100 yards back. One of them pointed and shouted something, and then they rushed toward him. Ethan hustled through the stairwell. A pair of automatic glass doors were sliding together straight ahead of him. He turned sideways, barely managing to squeeze through as they closed after him. It was the epic proportions of the next room that took him aback, the mad scope of this place bringing him to a full stop. He no longer stood on tile, but on cold rock, and at the edge of a cavern the size of 10 warehouses, 1,000,000 square feet at least if he had to guess, and the distance from floor to ceiling 60 feet in places. In all his life, he'd only seen 1 space more impressive, the Boeing plant in Everett, Washington. Giant globes of light hung down from the rocky ceiling, each one illuminating 1,000-square-foot section of floor space. There were hundreds of them. The glass doors had begun to spread open behind him, and he could hear the footsteps of those black-garbed men. They'd already covered half the distance of the corridor. Ethan ran into the cavern and shot down a passageway between shelves laden with lumber of every dimension. The shelves were 40 feet tall, 3 deep on either side, and extended the length of a football field, Ethan figuring they contained enough linear board feet to rebuild Wayward Pines 5 times over. Numerous voices echoed through the cavern. Ethan glanced over his shoulder, saw someone 200 feet back, sprinting toward him. He broke out of the narrow canyon between the shelves. Straight ahead, the floor space was overrun by hundreds of cylindrical reservoirs, 30 feet tall and just as wide, each capable of holding 10s of 1,000s of cubic feet, each labeled in huge, block letters as tall as Ethan. Rice, flour, sugar, grain, iodized salt, corn, vitamin C, soybeans, powdered milk, malt, barley, yeast. Ethan ran into the labyrinth of containers. He could hear footfalls very close, but with all the spatial interference, it was impossible to pinpoint their location. He stopped and leaned against a reservoir, breathing into his shirt in the crook of his arm, fighting to mask the noise of his panting. A man in black fatigues bolted past, holding a walkie-talkie in one hand and something that resembled a cattle prod in the other. Ethan waited 10 seconds and then changed course, threading his way through the containers for another 100 yards until he emerged into a parking lot of cars. The vehicles ranged in type from early '80s to present to models he'd never seen before. Curvaceous, compact designs that looked more like radical concept cars than anything that belonged on a public street. Every vehicle, without exception, sported gleaming chrome and unblemished paint jobs under the hanging globe lights, all looking as new and shiny as if they'd just rolled off the assembly line 30 seconds prior. A group of men jogged into view on the far side of the parking lot. Ethan ducked between a couple of red Jeep Cherokees, didn't know if he'd been seen, but he felt confident he'd spotted automatic weapons. He crawled for several car lengths and then rose up slowly beside a driver's door until he was peering through the windshield of an early '80s model Impala. They were closer than he'd realized, just 30 feet away now and all armed with submachine guns. Two of them shined flashlights into the interior of every vehicle they passed, while the third crawled behind on hands and knees, putting a light under each car. Ethan headed in the opposite direction, not bothering to crawl, just running hunched over on the uneven rock and trying to make sure his head wasn't visible through any glass. Near the edge of the parking lot, he stumbled past a Crown Vic with tinted windows in the rear passenger door. He stopped and, with absolute precision, pulled on the handle and tugged the door open without a sound. The dome light blazed on, and Ethan scrambled inside, jerking the door shut after him with just a touch too much force. Even from inside the car, he could hear the echo of the slammed door riding through the cavern. Crouching down in the shadows behind the driver's seat, Ethan glanced over the headrest and through the windshield. The trio of men were all standing now, each slowly turning, trying to ascertain where the noise had originated. They finally split up, two moving away from Ethan, but one heading straight toward his car. As the man approached, Ethan got down behind the seat and curled up into as small and compact a ball as he could make himself. The footsteps drew near. He had his head tucked between his knees, couldn't see a thing. Then the footsteps were right at his head, inches away on the other side of the door. They didn't trail away. They had stopped. The urge to lift his head to see what was happening so strong it nearly overcame him. He wondered if the man was spotlighting the interior of the Crown Vic, wondered how well the light would pass through the rear-tinted windows. If he could get a decent glimpse inside, would he just open the door? The footsteps went on, but Ethan didn't move. Waited another 5 minutes until he could no longer hear them. Finally, he sat up and stared through the windshield. The men were gone. He didn't see anyone. Ethan eased the door open and crawled down onto the rock. If he strained to listen, he could hear voices, but they were much farther off, in some distant region of the cavern. 100 feet of crawling brought Ethan to the edge of the parking lot. Straight ahead stood the cavern wall and the opening to a tunnel broad enough for 2 cars to travel abreast. Ethan rose up onto his feet and crossed to the tunnel. It was empty and well lighted, and fell away from where he stood in a straight shot that descended at a 10% or 12% grade over pristine pavement. A sign had been affixed to the rock above the arched opening. White letters on green background, just like the signage of the American Interstate Highway System. But it listed only one destination. Wayward Pines, 3.5. Ethan glanced back at all the cars, thinking maybe he could borrow one of the older models, which were much easier to hotwire. Something caught his eye, a chill blue light coming from a glass door in the rock 50 yards away. The sound of footsteps and voices came back into range, still a good distance away, beyond the cars. Ethan thought he saw the beam of a flashlight strike one of the reservoirs, but he couldn't be sure. He kept close to the wall of the cavern. It curved gently as he jogged alongside it toward the glass door. 5 feet away, he stopped. As the door slid open, he read a single word stenciled on the glass. Suspension. Ethan stepped inside. The door zipped closed behind him. It was much colder, just a few degrees above freezing, and his breath plumed in the chill. The light was frigid blue, like sunshine passing through sea ice, and the air was murky with a pale gas that hovered 10 feet above, thick enough to completely mask the ceiling like a cloud. And yet this room had the clean, rinsed smell of a post-snowstorm night, odorless and pure. The noise of hissing gas and soft beeps broke the silence. Approximately the dimensions of a grocery store, the room housed row after row of charcoal-colored units, hundreds and hundreds of them, each the size of a drink machine, each spitting a white stream of gas from its roof like a smoking chimney. Ethan walked down the first aisle and faced one of the machines. A 2-inch-wide panel of glass ran down the middle, nothing to see behind it. To the left of the glass, a keypad was framed with several gauges and readouts, all of them zeroed out. To the right of the glass, he studied a digital nameplate. Janet Catherine Palmer, Topeka, Kansas. Suspension date, 2-3-82. Resident, 11 years, 5 months, 9 days. Ethan heard the door slide open, turned to see who'd entered, but the waves of gas blocked his view. He moved on down the aisle, deeper into the fog, glancing at the nameplate on each machine he passed, the suspension dates progressing steadily through the 1980s. One stopped him altogether as voices mixed in with the sound of escaping gas and beeps. Behind the center pane of glass, it looked as if the interior of the machine had been packed with black sand. Just barely poking through, he saw a white finger, motionless, its tip resting against the glass beneath a fingerprint smudge. The gauges displayed what appeared to be a flatlined heart monitor and a temperature reading of 21.1111 degrees Celsius. The nameplate, Brian Laney Rogers, Missoula, Montana, suspension date, 5584. Integration attempts, 2. The next machine down stood empty, but Ethan recognized the first name, wondered if it was her. Beverly Lynn Short, Boise, Idaho. Suspension date, 10-3-85. Integration attempts, 3. Terminated. There was someone moving quickly toward him now. He tore himself away from Beverly's unit, mind reeling as he ran to the end of the aisle and started up the next. What the hell did this mean? There must have been a half dozen people in the room now, all chasing him, but he didn't care. Just needed to see one more unit. Had to see it. And on the fourth row, midway down the aisle, with voices closing in, he stopped. Stared at the empty machine. His empty machine. John Ethan Burke, Seattle, Washington. Suspension date, 9-24-12. Integration attempts, 3. Termination, in progress. Reading his name didn't make it any more real. He stood there not knowing what to do with the information in front of him, trying to piece together what it meant. For the first time in what seemed like forever, he couldn't care less about running. Ethan! He knew this voice, although it took him a moment to link it back to the memory, to the face it belonged to. Ethan, we need to talk! Yes, we do. It was Jenkins, the psychiatrist. Ethan started walking. He felt like he'd been unraveling for days, but now he was getting down to the end of the string, wondering what exactly was going to happen when it all ran out. Ethan, please! He wasn't even looking at names anymore, or to see which machine was occupied, which one empty. Only one thing mattered, one terrible suspicion gnawing his guts out. "We don't want to hurt you. No one touches him." It was all he could do to make his legs work as he approached the last machine on the last row in the farthest corner of the room. Men followed him now. He could sense them close behind in the fog. No chance at escaping now, but then, did it really matter anymore? He arrived at the last machine and put his hand against the glass to brace himself. Surrounded by black sand, a man's face pressed against the narrow window down the front. Eyes open, unblinking. No breath to fog the inside of the glass. Ethan read the nameplate and the year of suspension. 2032. He turned around as Dr. Jenkins emerged out of the fog, the small, unassuming man flanked by five of those black-clad men dressed in something approaching full riot gear. Jenkins said, "Please don't make us hurt you." Ethan shot a glance up the last aisle. Two more figures loomed in the fog. He was cornered. Said, "What is this?" "I understand you want to know, do you?" The psychiatrist studied him for a moment. "You look terrible, Ethan." "So I was what? Frozen?" "You were chemically suspended." "What does that even mean?" "To oversimplify, we use hydrogen sulfide to induce hypothermia. Once the core temperature is at ambient levels, we pack you in volcanic sand and crank up the sulfur gas to a concentration that kills all aerobic bacteria. Then we attack the anaerobic, basically anything that supports cell senescence. This puts you in a highly efficient state of suspended animation." "So you're telling me that, at least for a time, I was dead?" "No. Dead, by definition, is something that can't be undone. We like to think of it as turning you off in such a way that allows us to turn you on again, to reboot you. Keep in mind, I'm giving you the dummy's guide to a very delicate and complex process, one that took decades to perfect." Jenkins moved forward with the caution he might have used to approach a rabid animal. His thugs kept close, inching forward themselves, but he waved them back, stopping 2 feet away from Ethan and reaching out slowly until his hand touched Ethan's shoulder. "I understand this is a lot to take in. That fact is not lost on me. You aren't crazy, Ethan. I know that. I've always known that. So what is this all about, then? What does it mean? You'd like for me to show you? What do you think?" "All right, Ethan. All right. But I have to warn you. I'm going to ask for something in return." "What?" Jenkins didn't answer. Instead, he just smiled and touched something to Ethan's side. Ethan heard clicking, realized what was coming a half second before it hit him, like jumping into a freezing lake, every muscle flexing in unison, his knees locking and a blast furnace burn at the excruciating point of contact. Then he was on the ground, his entire body vibrating and Jenkins' knee digging into the small of his back. The pinch of a needle sliding into the side of his neck cut through the effects of the electromuscular disruption, and Jenkins must have hit a vein, because almost immediately, the pain of the taser hit melted away. The pain of everything melted away. The euphoric rush coming fast and hard, and Ethan struggling to see through it, to keep a finger on the fear of what was happening. But the drug was too beautiful, too heavy. It pulled him under into a painless bliss. Chapter 17. Barely 2 seconds have elapsed since the last grain of black sand emptied from the upper bulb of the hourglass when the door unlocks and swings open. Asif stands in the doorway, smiling. It is the first time Ethan has seen him without a hood, and it strikes him that this does not look like a man who is capable of doing the things to Ethan he has promised he will do. His face is clean-shaven with only the faintest peppering of stubble, hair black and mid-length and greased back. "Which of your parents was white?" Ethan asks.
"My mother was British."
Asif steps into the room. At the desk, he stops and stares down at the sheet of paper, points to it. "I trust it is not blank on the other side." He turns it over, studies it for a moment, and shakes his head as his eyes rise to Ethan's.
"You were to write down something that made me happy. Did you not understand my instructions?"
"Your English is fine. I understood." "Then maybe you do not believe I will do what I have said."
"No, I believe you."
"What then? Why did you not write something?"
"But I did."
"In invisible ink?" Now Ethan smiles. It takes everything within his power to stifle the tremor that keeps threatening to move through his hands. He holds up his left.
"I wrote this," he says, showing the tattoo he carved into his palm with the tip of the ballpoint pen, dark blue and sloppy, his hand still bleeding in places.
But given the time constraints and the circumstance, it was the best he could do. He says, "I know that soon I will be screaming, in terrible pain. Every time you wonder what I'm thinking, even though I may not be able to speak, you can just look at my hand and take those two words to heart." It's an American saying. I trust you understand its full meaning.
"You have no idea,"
Asif whispers, and for the first time, Ethan registers unchecked emotion in the man's eyes. Through the fear, he makes himself catalog the satisfaction of having broken this monster's cool, knowing it may be his only moment of victory in this brutal transaction.
"Actually, I do," Ethan says.
"You will torture me, break me, and eventually murder me. I know exactly what's coming. I just have one request." This elicits a subtle smile.
"What?"
"Quit telling me how much of a stud you are, you piece of shit. Whip it out and show me." All day, Asif shows him. Some hours later, Ethan snaps back to consciousness. Asif sets the bottle of smelling salts on the table beside the knives.
"Welcome back. Have you seen yourself?" the man asks him.
Ethan has lost all concept of how long he's been down here in the brown-walled room, without windows, that smells of death and rancid blood.
"Look at your leg."
Asif's face is beaded with sweat.
"I said, look at your leg."
When Ethan refuses, Asif reaches his bloody fingers into an earthenware vessel, comes out with a handful of salt. He flings it at Ethan's leg, screams through the ball gag. Agony. Unconsciousness.
"Do you understand how completely I own you, Ethan? How I will always own you? Do you hear me?"
Truer words. Ethan has placed himself in another world, trying to follow a line of thought that leads to his wife, to her giving birth to their firstborn, and him in the hospital with her. But the pain keeps dragging him back into now.
"I can make it end," Asif purrs into his ear. "I can also keep you alive for days. Whatever I want. I know it hurts. I know you're in more pain than you ever knew a person was capable of experiencing. But consider that I've only been working on one leg, and I'm very good at this. I will not allow you to bleed to death. You will only die when it pleases me."
There is undeniable intimacy between them. Asif cutting, Ethan screaming. At first Ethan hadn't watched, but now he can't tear his eyes away. Asif forces him to drink water and shovels lukewarm beans into his mouth,
all the while talking to him in the most casual tone, as if he were merely a barber and Ethan had popped in for a trim. Later, Asif sits in the corner drinking water and watching Ethan, studying his handiwork with a mix of amusement and pride. He wipes his brow and rises to his feet, the hem of his dishdasha dripping Ethan's blood. "Tomorrow morning, first thing, I will castrate you, cauterize the wound with a blowtorch, and then go to work on your upper body. Think about what you want for breakfast." He turns off the light on his way out of the room. All night, Ethan hangs in darkness, waiting. Sometimes he hears footsteps stop outside the door, but it never opens. The pain is titanic, but he manages to think clearly about his wife and the child he will never know. He whispers to Teresa from this dungeon and wonders if she can hear him. He moans and he cries, trying to come to grips with the idea that he is meeting this end. Even years later, it will be this moment, hanging alone in the dark with nothing but the pain and his thoughts and the waiting for tomorrow, that will haunt him. Always waiting for Asif's return. Always wondering what his son or daughter will look like. What their name will be. Always wondering how Teresa will get on without him. She will even say to him for months later, sitting at the breakfast table in their kitchen in Seattle as the rain falls, "It's like you never came back to me, Ethan." And he will say, "I know," as the cries of his son come through the baby monitor, thinking, "Asif didn't just take physical pieces out of me." And then the door finally opens, razor blades of light streaming in, bringing Ethan back to consciousness, back to the pain. When his eyes adjust to the onslaught of daylight, it isn't the silhouette of Asif he sees, but the bulky profile of a SEAL in full gear holding an M4 with an ACOG whose barrel gives off wisps of smoke. He shines a light on Ethan and says with a thick West Texas drawl, "Jesus!" Teresa thinks the leg wounds are from the crash. The SEAL is a sergeant, last name Brooks, and he carries Ethan on his back up a narrow flight of stairs, out of the basement dungeon into a kitchen where pieces of meat are burning on a skillet. Breakfast interruptus. Three Arab men lie dead in the hall, and five members of the SEAL team occupy the cramped kitchen, one of them kneeling down beside Asif, tying a strip of cloth around his left leg above the knee, which bleeds from a gunshot wound. Brooks lowers Ethan into a chair and growls at his medic, "Get away from him!" He stares down at Asif. "Who cut up this soldier?" Asif responds to the question with something in Arabic. "Me no hablo whatever the fuck you just said." "It's him," Ethan says. "He did this to me." For a moment there is nothing in the kitchen but the stench of burning meat and the gunpowder from the firefight. "We'll have air in 2 minutes," Brooks says to Ethan. "This is the only cocksucker left, and there's no one in this room gonna say shit about what you do." A soldier standing by the stove and holding a sniper rifle says, "Fucking A." "Can you stand me up?" Ethan asks. Brooks hauls Ethan out of his seat, Ethan groaning as he inches his way across the kitchen toward Asif. When they're standing over him, the SEAL unholsters a SIG. Ethan takes it out of his hand, checks the load. It will occur to him months from now that if this had been a movie, he wouldn't have done it, wouldn't have sunk to the level of this monster. But the ugly truth is, it never even crosses Ethan's mind not to do it. And though he will continually dream about the crash, about all the things Asif did to him, this moment will never haunt him. He will only wish it could have lasted longer. Ethan is naked, on his feet only with the support of Brooks, his legs like something that belongs in a butcher shop. He tells Asif to look at him. In the distance he can hear the distinctive whop-whop of the approaching Black Hawk. Beyond that, it is as quiet as mass out on the street. The torturer and the tortured hold eye contact for a long second. Asif says, "You are still mine, you know." As he smiles, Ethan shoots him through the face. The next time he comes to consciousness, he leans against the window of the Black Hawk, staring 300 feet down at the streets of Fallujah. Morphine gliding through his system, and Brooks's voice screaming in his ear that he's safe, that he's going home, and that 2 days ago, his wife gave birth to a healthy baby boy. Chapter 18. Ethan opened his eyes. His head leaned against a window, and he was staring down at mountainous terrain scrolling past at 150 miles per hour. Cruising, if he had to guess, at 2,500 feet AGL. He'd flown an air ambulance for 6 months after returning from Iraq and before applying to the Secret Service, and he recognized not only the voice of the Lycoming turbines roaring above his head, but the dimensions of the BK-117 airframe. He'd flown this model with Flight for Life. Raising his head off the glass, he moved to scratch an itch on the side of his nose, but found his hands cuffed behind his back. The passenger cabin had been arranged in a standard configuration, 4 seats divided between 2 facing rows, and a cargo space in the rear of the fuselage, hidden behind a curtain. Jenkins and Sheriff Pope sat across, and Ethan felt pleased to see the lawman's nose still bandaged. Nurse Pam, having traded her classic nurse's uniform for black cargo pants, a long-sleeved black tee, BDUs, and an H&K tactical shotgun, sat beside him, a half-moon trail of sutures curving from a shaved portion of her skull across her temple and midway down her cheek. Beverly had been responsible for that, and Ethan noted a flicker of rage at the memory of what had been done to that poor woman. Jenkins' voice crackled through the headset. "How you feeling, Ethan?" Though he felt groggy from the meds, his head had already begun to clear, but he didn't answer, just stared. "Apologies for the shock yesterday, but we couldn't take any chances. You've proven you're more than capable of handling yourself, and I didn't want to risk any further loss of life. Yours or my men." "Loss of life, huh? That's what you're so worried about now?" "We also took the liberty of rehydrating you, giving you some nourishment, new clothes, seeing to your injuries. I have to say, you look much better." Ethan glanced out the window. Endless pine forests streaming through valleys and over hills that occasionally climbed above the timberline into sheer rock escarpments. "Where are you taking me?" Ethan asked. "I'm keeping my word." "To who?" "You. I'm showing you what this is all about." "I don't under—" "You will." "How much longer, Roger?" The pilot broke in over the headset. "Have you on the ground in 15. It was a jaw-dropping sweep of backcountry. No roads, no houses, as far as Ethan could see. Just forested hills and the occasional squiggle of water through the trees, glimpses of stream and river. Soon, the pine forest fell away behind them, and Ethan could tell by the pitch change of the twin turbine that the pilot had initiated their descent. They flew over brown, arid-looking foothills, which, over the course of 10 miles, flowed down into a vast hardwood conifer forest. At 200 feet AGL, the helicopter banked and circled the same square mile of real estate for several minutes while Pope studied the terrain through a pair of binoculars. He finally spoke into his mic.
"We're looking good."
They sat down in a large clearing surrounded by towering oaks in full autumn color, the rotors stirring the grass in long wavelengths that expanded out from the helicopter in concentric circles. Ethan gazed across the field while the engines powered down. Jenkins said, "Would you join me for a little hike, Ethan?" Pam reached over, unbuckled his lap belt and shoulder harness. "Cuffs too?" she asked. Jenkins looked at Ethan.
"You'll behave?"
"Sure." Ethan leaned forward so Pam could access the keyhole. The bracelets popped open. He stretched his arms out and massaged his wrists. Jenkins looked at Pope, opened his hand, said, "You bring something for me like I asked?" The sheriff filled it with a stainless steel revolver that looked beefy enough to have been bored out for .357 Magnum cartridges. Jenkins looked dubious.
"I've seen you shoot," Pope said. "You'll be fine. Anywhere near the heart, or better yet, a headshot, and you're golden."
Pope reached back behind his seat and came up with an AK-47, outfitted with a 100-round drum. Ethan watched him switch the mode from safety to 3-round burst. Jenkins pulled off his headset. Then he swept aside the curtain between the passenger cabin and the cockpit, said to the pilot, "We'll be on Channel 4, and you'll hear from us if we need to leave in a hurry."
"I'll keep my finger on the engine start."
"You radio at the first sign of trouble."
"Yes, sir."
"Arnie left you a gun?"
"2, in fact."
"We won't be long." Jenkins opened the cabin door and climbed out. After Pope and Pam, Ethan followed, stepping down onto the skid and then into the soft, waist-high grass. He caught up with Jenkins, and the four of them moved quickly across the field, Pope out in front with the assault rifle, Pam bringing up the rear. It was late in the day, a crisp, golden afternoon. Everyone seemed twitchy and nervous, like they were out on a patrol. Ethan said, "Ever since I came to Wayward Pines, you've done nothing but fuck with me. What are we doing out here in the goddamn wilderness? I want to know right now." They entered the woods, slogging their way through a riot of underbrush, the noise of birds getting louder. "But Ethan, this isn't the wilderness." Ethan glimpsed something barely visible through the trees, realized he'd initially missed it because of all the vegetation. He quickened his pace, now clawing his way through the bushes and saplings that comprised the forest understory, Jenkins following closely behind. When Ethan arrived at the base of it, he stopped and looked up. For a moment, he didn't understand exactly what he was staring at. Down low, the beams were wrapped in several feet of dead and living vines, the brown and the green camouflaging the shape of the structure, blending it so seamlessly into the color of the forest that if you looked at it askance, it disappeared. Higher up, the color of the steel beams showed through, rust so deep it verged on red, centuries of oxidation. 3 oak trees had grown up right through the heart of it, twisting and turning as they climbed, some of the branches even providing support for the girders. Only the framework of the lower 6 floors still stood, the corroded skeleton of a building. A handful of beams near the top had bent over and curled like ringlets of auburn-colored hair, but most of the steelwork had long ago collapsed into the center to be subsumed by the forest floor. The sound of birds coming from the ruin was tremendous, like an avian high-rise. Nests everywhere Ethan looked. "Remember when you told me you wanted to be transferred to a hospital in Boise?" Jenkins asked.
"Yeah."
"Well, I've brought you to Boise, right into the center of town."
"What are you talking about?"
"You're looking at the U.S. Bank building, tallest skyscraper in Idaho. That's where the Secret Service's Boise field office is located, right? Up on 17?
"You're out of your mind."
"I know this looks like a forest floor, but we're actually standing in the middle of Capitol Boulevard. The state capitol is just a third of a mile through those trees, although to find any trace of it, you'd have to dig."
"What is this? Some kind of trick?"
"I told you." Ethan grabbed the man by his collar and pulled Jenkins in close. "Start making sense. You were put into suspended animation. You saw the units. For how long? Ethan, how long?" Jenkins gave a slight pause, Ethan realizing there was something in him that almost didn't want to hear the answer. 1,814 years, Ethan let go of Jenkins's shirt. 5 months, he staggered back, and 11 days. Looked at the ruin. Looked at the sky. You should get off your feet, Jenkins said. Let's sit. As Ethan eased down into a bed of ferns, Jenkins glanced up at Pope and Pam. You guys give us a minute, all right? But don't go far. They walked off. Jenkins sat down across from Ethan. Your mind is racing, he said. Will you try not to think for a minute and just listen to me? It had rained here recently. Ethan could feel the dampness of the ground through the pair of brown fatigues they'd dressed him in. Let me ask you something, Jenkins said. When you think of the greatest breakthrough discovery in history, what comes to mind? Ethan shrugged. Come on, humor me. Space travel? Theory of relativity? I don't know. The greatest discovery in the history of mankind was learning how man would become extinct. As a species? Precisely. In 1971, a young geneticist named David Pilcher made a startling discovery. Keep in mind, this was before RNA splicing, before DNA polymorphism. He realized the human genome, which is essentially the entirety of our heredity information, which programs cell growth, was changing, becoming corrupted. By what? By what? Jenkins laughed. By everything. By what we'd already done to the Earth, and by all that we would do in the coming centuries. Mammal extinction, deforestation, loss of polar sea ice, ozone, increased carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere, acid rain, ocean dead zones, overfishing, offshore oil drilling, wars, the creation of a billion gasoline-burning automobiles, the nuclear disasters, Fukushima, Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, the 2,000-plus intentional nuclear bomb detonations in the name of weapons testing, toxic waste dumping, Exxon Valdez, BP's Gulf oil spill, all the poisons we put into our food and water every day. Since the Industrial Revolution, we've treated our world like it was a hotel room and we were rock stars. But we aren't rock stars. In the scheme of evolutionary forces, we are a weak, fragile species. Our genome is corruptible, and we so abused this planet that we ultimately corrupted that precious DNA blueprint that makes us human. But this man, Pilcher, he saw what was coming. Maybe not specifically, but in broad strokes, saw that over successive generations, because of the substantial environmental changes we were bringing to bear, there was the potential for tachytelic anagenesis. To put it in terms you might understand, rapid macroevolutionary change. What am I saying? From human to something other in 30 generations. To put it in biblical terms, Pilcher believed a flood was coming, so he decided to build an ark. Are you following me? Not at all. Pilcher thought if he could preserve a number of pure humans before the corruption reached critical mass, they could, in effect, sit out the evolutionary changes which would lead to the destruction of human civilization and our species. But to achieve this, it would require a robust suspended animation technology. He set up a lab and dropped his billions into R&D. Nailed it by 1979 and started work fabricating 1,000 suspension units. Meanwhile, Pilcher had been looking for a small town to house his cargo, and when he stumbled across Wayward Pines, he knew it was perfect, secluded, defendable ground. Closed in by those high mountain walls, tough to access, tough to leave. He bought up all the residential and commercial properties and started construction on a bunker complex deep in the surrounding mountains. It was a massive project. Took 22 years to finish. How did the supplies keep all of this time? Ethan asked. Wood and food couldn't have lasted nearly 2,000 years. Until the crew reanimated the warehouse cavern, the dormitories and surveillance center, literally every square inch of that complex existed in a vacuum. It wasn't perfect, and we did lose some material, but enough survived to rebuild the Wayward Pines infrastructure, which time and the elements had completely erased. But the cave system we utilized contained minimal moisture content in the air, and since we were able to kill off 99.9% of all bacteria, it turned out to be almost as efficient as suspension itself.
So the town is completely self-sufficient?
Yes, it functions like an Amish village or a pre-industrial society. And as you saw, we have vast stores of staples which we do package and truck into town.
I saw cows. Did you create suspension chambers for livestock as well?
No, we just put some embryos in stasis, then used artificial wombs.
There was no such thing in 2012, but there was in 2030.
Where's Pilcher now?
Jenkins grinned. Ethan said, "You?"
"Your colleagues, Kate Hewson and Bill Evans, when they disappeared in Wayward Pines, they were trying to find me. Some of my business dealings had fallen onto the Secret Service radar. That's why you're sitting here right now."
"You kidnapped federal agents?
Locked them away?"
"Yes."
"And many others?"
"Aside from my hand-picked and extravagantly compensated crew, I didn't think I'd get much in the way of volunteers for an endeavor of this nature."
"So you abducted people who came to Wayward Pines?"
"Some came to town and I took them there. Others I sought out."
"How many?"
650 were conscripted over the course of 50 years.
"You're a psychopath."
Pilcher seemed to consider the accusation, his cool, dark eyes intense and thoughtful. It was the first time Ethan had really looked into the man's face, and he realized the shaved head and good skin belied Pilcher's age. The man must have been in his early 60s, possibly older. Ethan had, up until this moment, written off his utterly precise, controlled manner of speaking as a gimmick, a shrink's ruse, but now he saw it for what it was, clear evidence of an immense intellect. It struck him that he was sitting out here under a canopy of oak trees with the sharpest mind he'd ever encountered, something both thrilling and terrifying in that.
Pilcher finally said, "I don't see it quite that way."
"No? How then?"
"More like the savior of our species."
"You stole people from their families."
"You still don't get it, do you?"
"Get what?"
"What Wayward Pines is. Ethan, it's the last town on Earth. A living time capsule for our way of life. For the American dream. The residents, the crew, me, you, we're all that's left of the species Homo sapiens."
"And you know this how?"
"I've sent out a handful of reconnaissance teams over the years. Those who made it back reported the most hostile conditions imaginable. Without the protection and infrastructure of a place like Wayward Pines, no one could survive. Since my crew came out of suspension 14 years ago, we've had a radio beacon continuously transmitting a distress call on every known emergency frequency. I even made the decision to broadcast the coordinates of Pines on the remote chance that there were other humans out there. No one's shown up on our doorstep. No one's ever made contact. I said this is Boise, but it's not. There is no Boise, no Idaho, no America. Names no longer mean a thing."
"How did it all end?"
"We'll never know, will we?"
I went to sleep shortly after you so I could still have 25 years in Wayward Pines post-suspension. And after 2032, we were all sleeping in the mountain. But if I had to guess, by 2300 I estimated we'd see major abnormalities cropping up, and with diversity being the raw material of evolution, by 2500 we could have been classified as completely different species, each generation getting closer and closer to something that could thrive in this toxic world, something less and less human. You can imagine the social and economic ramifications, an entire civilization built for humanity crumbling. I'm guessing there were genocides. Maybe the end came over 40 terrible years. Maybe it took 1,000. Maybe a full-scale nuclear war wiped out billions in the span of a month. I'm sure many thought it was end times. But we'll never have that piece of knowledge. All we know is what's out there now. And what is that? Aberrations. We call them abbeys. Those translucent-skinned creatures that nearly killed you in the canyon. Since coming out of suspension, I've traveled only 3 times by helicopter, including today. It's quite risky. Farthest we got was Seattle, or where Seattle used to be. We had to haul fuel, barely made it back. Extrapolating from what I saw, there must be hundreds of millions of those creatures just on this continent alone. They're predators, of course, and if their population is as healthy as I'm projecting, this would point to a burgeoning deer or other ruminant population. It's even possible that some descendant of the bison is once again roaming the plains in large numbers. Because we can't leave the valley to conduct research, we have only a small sample from which to gauge which species survived the last 2,000 years unscathed. Birds seem to have come through unaffected, some insects. But then you'll realize something's missing. For instance, there are no crickets, no lightning bugs, and in 14 years I haven't seen a single bee. What are these abbeys? It's easy to think of them as mutants or aberrations, but our name for them truly is a misnomer. Nature doesn't see things through the prism of good or bad. It rewards efficiency. That's the beautiful simplicity of evolution. It matches design to environment. In trashing our world, we forced our own transformation into a descendant species from Homo sapiens that adapted through natural selection to survive the destruction of human civilization. Line our DNA sequences up side by side, and only 7 million letters are different. That's about 0.5%. Jesus. From a logistical standpoint, abbeys are hugely problematic. They're far more intelligent than the great apes, and exponentially more aggressive. We've captured a handful over the years, studied them, tried to establish communication, but it's all failed. Their speed and strength is more in line with your average Neanderthal man. At 60 pounds, they're lethal, and some of them grow to 200. You were lucky to survive. That's why you've built fences around Wayward Pines. It's sobering when you realize we aren't at the top of the food chain anymore. Occasionally, an abbey will get through, but we keep the outskirts of town on motion sensors and the entire valley under sniper surveillance, day and night. Then why didn't you just take you out? Jenkins smiled. At first, I wanted the people to do it. Once you reached the canyon, we knew a pack of abbeys was in the area. You were unarmed. Why waste ammo? But the residents, they don't know about any of this? No. What do they think? They woke up here after an accident, just like you did. Re-injured, of course, in the appropriate places. Through our integration program, they come to understand there's no leaving. and we have rules and consequences to minimize the complications that arise when someone from 1984 lives next door to someone from 2015. For the residents to thrive, to reproduce, they can't know they're all that's left. They have to live like the world is still out there. But it's not. So what's the point of the lie? When you bring them out of suspension, why not just tell them, "Congratulations, you're the sole survivors"? We did that very thing with